California political leaders are trying to figure out how to deal with some of the gaps being created by the partial federal government shutdown. On Insight, I'll talk about that with Ben Adler in this week's Capital Chat. We're also going to look at some of the pushback that's happening against PG&E's plan to file bankruptcy next week. Then the fears and concerns of people living in California's high-risk wildfire area. What would you do if one of those fires was pushing toward your home or your community? Producer Sally Schilling will share stories from people that she's talked with in her reporting. Later, what's your hidden disability? If you're ready to laugh about it, and with a lot of other people who are laughing at theirs, how about the Invisible Disability Show? It's this Sunday. You'll hear all about it. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's Today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Of course, the big political news nationally today is that President Trump has put the State of the Union message on hold until the federal government shutdown ends. California, with a new governor, is waiting to hear the date for the State of the State message, which will be sometime in the next few weeks. We have that and more in this week's Capital Chat. Our Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler is standing by in downtown Sacramento at the Bureau. Hi there, Ben.
Hi, Beth.
So what is the latest on the State of the State plans and just a little bit about how important this address will be for Gavin Newsom?
Well, it's, of course, in his first year, first month right now as governor, it will be one additional opportunity for him to lay out what has been a very busy agenda for him so far. As far as what we know about it, not much. We know there will be one, and we know it does not need to be in January, even though they traditionally are. And I think Newsom, you know, he was sworn in January 7th. That's, you know, the latest date I think that he could have been sworn in because it's the first Monday of the of the new year. And then he 3 days later had to present his state budget on January 10th. And since then, he's been moving around and going around the state, and he's been busy. So, and of course, he had a couple of crises dumped in his lap, the Los Angeles teacher strike right. and the PG&E looming bankruptcy. So it wouldn't surprise me if we don't hear his State of the State until February. I mean, we're almost, you know, it's not going to happen this week. I think it's pretty clear. And, you know, next week there's a few days of January, but we'll see.
It was not a surprise that California Senator Kamala Harris announced, in fact, not even a surprise that she announced her run for president on the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. She has a rally scheduled this weekend. Tell me a bit about it, and I understand you're going to be there.
Yeah, it's going to be in Oakland at Frank Ogawa Plaza downtown. It's going to be around 12:45, at least it's scheduled to start then on Sunday. So yeah, she announced her candidacy on TV and online on Martin Luther King Day. This is going to be her first official campaign rally, and it's going to be in Oakland, you know, the East Bay, where she grew up. Now, her campaign headquarters is going to be in Baltimore because it's closer to Washington, and it's the Eastern time zone, which can help, I guess, with a bunch of logistical matters. But there's going to also be a second campaign office for her here in Northern California. So that's what we know at this point. No word yet about, you know, special speakers or anything like that. But we do know that at least she's likely to not be the only Californian entering the Democratic presidential primary. There's a lot of talk about Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti entering as well. And although Gavin Newsom was found to have political ads on social media and online in some swing presidential states in recent weeks, nobody is expecting him to get in the race, not this year.
So at that Oakland rally, you'll be live tweeting and sending reports. I understand you'll have Andrew Nixon with you as well, which means we'll get pictures, and that will be continuing news into next week. You did mention PG&E and the pending filing for bankruptcy. Let's spend a little bit of time there. First of all, is the plan, as PG&E announced it earlier in the month, is that plan still in place?
We have no reason to believe otherwise. It could file for bankruptcy as soon as next week when the 15 days lapse from when it sent its initial notice that it would file for bankruptcy. So, and then also next week, there's a looming court hearing and a Public Utilities Commission hearing. So those would be right after it files for bankruptcy, if it files on that date. PG&E has been quite tight-lipped, other than to put out statements and occasional filings with courts and the Securities and Exchange Commission about all this. So as far as I can tell, and I've been asking around pretty actively, there aren't any last-minute negotiations in the Capitol to avert bankruptcy, or if so, they have been kept, there's been a very tight lid kept on them, and there weren't any as of a couple of days ago. I'm pretty confident of that, unless some folks were just flat out lying to me, which is always possible in politics. But, you know, so I do know that there seem to be some sort of very, very early stage discussions between attorneys for wildfire victims in PG&E through the lens of and through the venue of a superior court in San Francisco, I believe, that has a, you know, there's supposed to be some sort of negotiations going on over the bigger picture that isn't necessarily involving bankruptcy. But if there is a settlement before bankruptcy, which seems like a long shot, but if it is, well, the wildfire victims would get their money a lot sooner than they would if PG&E enters bankruptcy. So that could be some motivation for victims to negotiate now rather than wait for the legal process to play itself out.
Pacific Gas and Electric says it's facing up to $30 billion in liabilities related to wildfires. Aaron Brockovich is part of a legal team that's representing victims from 2017 wildfires. She spoke out this week. That's part of the reaction that you've been gauging. So let's get to that, Ben, and what people are saying, because this is not a green light for PG&E's plan.
Well, Aaron Brockovich, who, of course, was played by Julia Roberts in the movie of the same name years ago about her efforts with PG&E in another part of the state. She was at the state capitol. She is involved in legal action with PG&E and also working for a law firm that's representing wildfire victims. So there's no question what her viewpoint is. But let's listen to a little bit of her berating PG&E at the state capitol earlier this week.
How are we going to stand by and just hurl 40,000 citizens who have been harmed, not to mention the state of California, into chaos because Pacific Gas and Electric once again doesn't want to be held accountable?
How's her testimony received? And talk to me about her tradition and her voice as a consumer advocate and somebody who has a long history of, as you said, taking on PG&E.
Well, I don't think that was a surprise what she was out there talking about. One thing, though, that struck me is I had been under the impression, the mistaken impression, that she was kind of representing the umbrella organization of consumer attorneys, of trial lawyers, the consumer attorneys of California. And turns out she's not. She was there with wildfire victims and one particular law firm representing victims from both the 2017 and 2018 fires, 2017 in Santa Rosa area, 2018 in Paradise in Butte County. And so it's not like all of the interests here are, you know, they may be aligned in many ways, but it's not like they're necessarily all on the same page. And it just shows, I mean, there's no guarantee that any of this is going to come together. In fact, it's likely it won't. It's likely we are headed into bankruptcy. And after that, as I think I discussed on the show last week with Rick Cushman, the guest host, it really becomes up to the federal bankruptcy judge and the negotiations that happen with all of the creditors, secured and unsecured. Wildfire victims are unsecured creditors. That means they don't have collateral in loans the way, you know, banks might do. And those secured creditors go to the front of the line. Unsecured creditors come next. Now, shareholders very likely could lose the value of their stock entirely. So they are not necessarily leaping ahead of folks, but there is certainly a question about how ratepayers and taxpayers would be affected, and wildfire victims might not be made whole or might not be made as whole as they would hope to be. So once PG&E goes into bankruptcy, there's you know, the state loses a lot of control and oversight that it might have over PG&E.
And that was part of Erin Brockovich's point, is that she wants stricter oversight of PG&E in general. She wants lawmakers to take action to go that route. The governor has said it's part of his agenda to try to keep PG&E out of bankruptcy. But what you're saying is maybe neither of those goals will be met.
I don't think it's going to be it's really not for me to say whether I think it's going to be possible for PG&E to stay in or out of bankruptcy. All signs currently point to PG&E filing for bankruptcy. Things can change, but all signs point that way right now. And so that's what made there be a fairly significant disconnect when Erin Brockovich and her colleagues and the wildfire victims held that news conference at the Capitol, because they're calling on the state to help wildfire victims and prevent PG&E from going into bankruptcy. But you can't really do there isn't a lot the state can do short of
a bailout package. PG&E. There would have to be a bailout package, correct?
The state would have to provide some aid or relief to PG&E, or provide some aid and relief to wildfire victims, etc., which would be perceived to be, in either case, a bailout of PG&E. Now, bailout is a subjective word. There were folks who criticized the big wildfire liability law passed last year as a bailout, and just as many folks who said, no, it really wasn't. It's much more complicated than that, and it's not fair to use that word. So a bailout is in the eyes of the beholder, and a very easy political argument to make because it's instantly understood. And so I don't want to get too reliant on that word.
Sure.
But I think even if you don't use that word, if you describe aid as state aid to wildfire victims that otherwise PG&E would be legally required to provide, then that can be interpreted by a lot of people to be a bailout.
You're listening to Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler. Let's shift topics a bit here, because the ongoing government shutdown is prompting officials in California to try to fill in some of the gap that's left. Will you talk about the governor's offer of unemployment payments to federal employees? And is that essentially a loan, Ben?
Yeah, so, it's funny because just as we went on the air, I got a press release and a letter from the U.S. Department of Labor, which I have been trying and to some point failing to scan through while we've been on the air. But it's talking about unemployment benefits for workers who have been required to report to work but are not currently getting paid. Of course, they're going to be paid. We know because President Trump signed a law guaranteeing back pay to federal workers once the shutdown ends. But right now, they don't have money. And we've heard that some are going to food banks. And we saw this morning that Trump's Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross was quoted as saying he doesn't understand why federal employees have had to go to food banks. I think federal employees who have gone to food banks would say, we don't have money. We rely on paychecks. We live paycheck to paycheck, and we have no choice but to get all of the help we can get. There's folks who are struggling with their loans and their mortgage payments and the like. And Gavin Newsom went to the Sacramento airport last week, hours after I was last on Insight. And so we didn't get a chance to talk about this last week. And Newsom was saying, look, we're going to provide, and he was talking to TSA workers who are required to work without pay. And he's saying, we're going to provide you unemployment benefits. He also said the U.S. Department of Labor told us we can't do that the law doesn't allow us to provide unemployment aid to people who are working, even if they are not at the moment getting paid. And Newsom said, shame on them, we're going to do it anyway. Well, this letter that just came out from the U.S. Department of Labor appears to say, look, states, we can't change the law. We don't think we have the legal right to waive the requirements. You can go ahead and use state funds to offer unemployment aid to federal workers who are working without pay during the shutdown. But you can't use federal money. We're not going to reimburse. And you need to make sure that the workers you provide the unemployment aid to pay you back, reimburse the state once they get paid by the federal government whenever the shutdown ends. Mm-hmm. So this does appear to be a change in posture from the Department of Labor in the Trump administration.
All right. Another aspect of filling a gap right now is dealing with food stamp funding. And where is California on that? And this brings in Speaker Anthony Rendon and his efforts as well.
So to start with, we have to provide the little bit of background that the federal government, the Trump administration's U.S. Department of Agriculture, was trying to figure out how to provide food aid to people throughout the nation during the shutdown, because that's one of the departments that hasn't been appropriated. And they chose to, they came up with a way that they could provide aid for February if they do it in January before some statutory guidance runs out. The legalistics of the federal government, I'm not nearly as familiar with them as I am with the state government.
Okay.
They found a way. They basically were saying, look, we're going to go ahead and give we're going to fund the debit cards that are used for CalFresh and other food aid programs in other states several weeks ahead of time. So the February payment came down last week. And folks who receive that benefit are supposed to make the money last all the way through the end of February. Because regardless of, there wouldn't be a March payment if the government isn't open by March. But let's say, next week there's a deal. There's still, the aid's already been transmitted for February. So they still, regardless, would need to make it last until March. Well, Rendon is wondering whether there's anything California can do to help in the intervening weeks in addition to that. And he sent a letter to Gavin Newsom asking him to look at the options. And there are outside advocates like the Western Center for Law and Poverty who are urging the governor and legislature to do the same. So that's the question there. Will California provide any additional food aid, which would have to be out of its surplus, probably would not be reimbursed by the federal government. But of course, California has a large surplus. Whether California would consider doing that if the shutdown continues.
And the speaker is asking, and these are the words in the letter, to make sure that vital federal benefits like CalFresh continue uninterrupted in the weeks ahead. And he is inviting proposals from the administration. With that, let's talk about your conversation with Representative Jim Nielsen, too, because we are getting weigh-in from a lot of different arenas as state leaders in every state, of course, right now are trying to plug programs that have a vacuum, that have a gap.
So State Senator Jim Nielsen is the vice chair of the Senate Budget Committee, the top Republican on that committee. And last week I caught up with him and asked him about the context of our conversation was the TSA workers not getting unemployment and Governor Newsom choosing to do it anyway. And so here's basically what he told me is go ahead this one time, but don't make a habit of it. Let's listen.
The governor's good-hearted and trying to attempt to do this from the goodness of his heart. I respect that. My caution is if we in California start doing too many things, California alone, making it our burden and responsibility, it's going to make some real problems in the future for California. So I would just say wax cautious.
With that, though, a few steps toward how can we all work together to solve this problem? That's what I hear in his statement, Ben.
Yeah, and I also heard an effort from at least that particular California Republican to distance the state party from the Trump administration on this particular issue. Of course, the president is very unpopular here, and Republicans have been struggling with how to be a viable political party in the era of Trump. And I'm wondering whether this is going to be one of many future examples or just a lone example of Republicans kind of distancing themselves. I mean, you basically had Nielsen siding with Gavin Newsom on this, just saying, look, you can't do this for everything. And so now we bring up the context of CalFresh aid, food stamp aid. And so this is where we get into the wax cautious piece of Nielsen's advice. Okay, maybe do the unemployment aid, which really amounts to, as you mentioned, 0% loans, assuming that the state is able to get the money back from each federal worker who gets the unemployment aid once their paychecks arrive. That's relatively low risk to the state, doesn't involve in the long run spending a great deal of money. If you start offering these benefits that are normally done by the federal government at the state level, you're not always going to get all that money back. And in this case, you probably would not get the money back on the CalFresh aid. So it is something that Governor Newsom will need to balance.
All right, Ben, good Capital Chat. We covered a lot of ground. Thanks for making time for us today. And we'll look for more reporting, in particular, the Kamala Harris rally coming up in Oakland.
All right. Thanks a lot.
That is Ben Adler. He is Cap Radio's Capital Bureau Chief. You can find more state government news at capradio.org. And this is Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. About 20,000 California wildfires? That's the number CAL FIRE has recorded in the state from 1878 to 2017. The U.S. Geological Survey helped with data from 2018. And all of this means that you can find a color-coded data map of where these fires have and haven't happened in the state. The map is at capradio.org. It's quite stunning to take a look at it. I want to give credit to Emily Zentner and Chris Hagen for that work. What would you do? Where would you go if a wildfire was coming toward your home or burning toward your neighborhood? Those are the kinds of urgent questions now that are taking on an even more difficult tone for people who live in high-risk fire areas. Cap Radio producer Sally Schilling has been listening to these concerns and fears, attending community meetings, and she's here to share some of her reporting. Hi, Sally.
Hi, Beth.
Let me stay on that map for a moment. Thousands of fires over hundreds of years. But what's been happening recently with the mega fires? Is that changing the awareness and the sense of danger for people?
Yeah, I think in some ways it is. And in some ways it's not. I mean, a lot of the Sierra Foothill areas, for example, when I visited communities near Lake Oroville or Placerville or Nevada City Grass Valley, they're keenly aware of the fire history in their areas and over time, you know, have known, you know, going back decades, they'll still talk about specific fires that happened that destroyed hundreds of homes. But these fires are making people think differently now. We're seeing, you know, 87 deaths in the Camp Fire. We're seeing images and videos of people getting stuck in traffic and desperately trying to get out. Mass evacuations that no one, even the emergency planners, could have, they say, could have anticipated in some cases. And that's kind of shaken people all over the state that live in fire-prone areas.
So is it fair to say that they're talking about their vulnerabilities now differently?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And one of the things, there's so many different pieces to looking at the fire preparedness puzzle. But one of them that I kept hearing over and over again at these meetings that have been called in the wake of the car and the campfires is, how are we going to get out? Are we going to get stuck in traffic somewhere on these narrow roads that we have to get out to maybe a 2 or 4 lane highway that, you know, merges it back down to 2 lanes? Is everyone going to get backed up somewhere? Are we even going to know where we are? And I went to Nevada County, actually, to this community near Grass Valley called Alta Sierra. It's about 7,000 people that live in that area. And this is just one example of a foothill community where it's a pretty dense development right in the middle of the forest and the foothills, high elevation. You're going up and down. And one person described Alta Sierra as, if you look at the maps of the roads there, it looks like spilled spaghetti. So I took a ride around that neighborhood with a retired firefighter, Chris Riley. And here's a little bit of us driving around and him talking about his concerns.
I just see the problem of too many cars hitting the road and you have one accident, or somebody's got a trailer and they get stuck and it jams up.
So, yeah, there we were driving around and I was starting to get car sick. We even kind of got lost at one point, you know, and he lives in that area. But it just goes to show this idea of getting out is something that a lot of people are kind of, you know, after seeing these recent very fast moving fires, thinking about everyone trying to get out at once. How is that going to look?
That is a steep canyon area. And that's another factor of the terrain. You are saying up and down hills, and anybody that's driven there and can get car sick knows exactly what you're talking about. But the canyons where the winds can whip and move the fires so fast before anybody can get in there and really deal with them is another factor there. Where are people with that idea that we only have one road out?
They're really worried, and they're out talking to their neighbors more about other, you know, private roads, or maybe there is another gravel road somewhere, and it's these just person-to-person conversations that we're seeing now that maybe there is another way or another alternative. Hey, if we did get stuck in traffic, maybe there's somewhere we could go, like we even saw in the campfire, people trying to shelter in place at a store or somewhere they could find. And I talked to another resident who's been super concerned recently in the Nevada County area, Scott Allen, and he took me around his area. And he, when we were driving past, it's so beautiful out there, the canyons, we were looking out, and there's big grassy pastures. Mm. And we stopped to talk to a rancher named Jim Gates. And you'll hear in their conversation here, first off, that they're both very aware of the fire danger that they live with as kind of longtime residents in the area. And then Scott also asked if maybe the pastures could be a place where if they had to, people could just run to if they got stuck in traffic. So here's a little bit of their conversation.
This fall, Nevada County was as dry as I've seen it in my 68 years, okay? And you go out there any night, you want to go out there, that's Deacon Hill, right on the other side of that Starvation Bar on the South Yuba. Any night, 6, 8, 10 campfires out there.
Wow.
By people that never even heard the word responsibility, let alone know what it really means.
Right. When we had a fire a couple years ago, you said, hey, use my field. I've got that irrigated pasture field.
Yeah.
And so what I'm concerned about is if we could even have a sign that so people know that this is an area they could shelter in place, because right now you can't outrun a fire.
What choice do we have?
Hmm. So that's interesting, though. Some proactive action on the part of landowners, homeowners, neighbors, residents, and that can be a whole additional network of safety or at least communication.
Yeah, and there's actually these community groups all over the state that have been in place in some places for a long time, but we're seeing more and more of them being formed now called fire safe councils. And these are really on the neighborhood level, but can kind of coordinate together. And in Nevada County, that has one of the highest numbers of these local fire safe councils of any county in the state. And the kinds of things they can do is hold meetings about, you know, just discussing basic preparedness, evacuation concerns, applying for grants. There's a lot of cap and trade money that can go to doing big fuel breaks or, oh, this is our one way in, one way out, but it's really overgrown. You know, we want to cut that back. We want to get people organized. Oh, we live in a gated community. Let's make sure someone has a key to that extra gate, that way out that we could take. So there's more people interested in forming these fire safe councils or joining their fire safe councils. But you know, these grassroots efforts are really hard to keep going over time. But I've found that, you know, in the wake of this past fall, there are people that are trying to ramp up these kinds of efforts. I went to a meeting near Placerville. There's a community called Pleasant Valley where a woman named Chris Avery is trying to restart the fire safe council in her area in the wake of the campfire. And here she kind of talks about what her area is like and, you know, why their fire safe council a few years ago was kind of moving in action and then why it kind of disbanded.
We are a very high fire danger area. We're rural. We're outside of the city limits of Placerville. And we're right below the Jenkinson Sly Park Lake area. So we've got some flatlands. We've got lots of foothill, mountainous roads, curves, lots of one way in, one way out type of situations.
What was the goal of the meeting tonight?
To get all hands on deck and reform this council so we can get to the work that needs to get done.
And why now?
Now's a good time because fire is on everyone's minds. When a big fire event happens, people get scared. When there's no fire, people don't think about it. It's not on their minds. They don't want to participate. Now they want to participate. So we've got to strike it while it's hot.
So yeah, there was a fire safe council here before. Can you talk about what happened with that?
Yeah, there was a fire safe council. We actually were pretty active for a couple of years. And we had a couple of big fires in 2014. And everybody was really interested. And about 2 years later, interest really dropped off. Even though we were having really successful public outreach meetings, giving people lots of information about evacuation and preparedness, they weren't interested in actually being part of the council and assisting us to do the work that needed to get done to get some of these projects done.
That is Chris Avery talking with CAP Radio producer Sally Schilling. And as they describe these fire safe councils, it reminds me of the grassroots efforts to take back the night or create neighborhood watch. And sometimes they're as strong as the people involved are. So now it sounds like this group really has a motivated leader in Chris.
Yeah, and I think you can even just hear in the background of that meeting that there's a lot of people there.
Did that surprise you that these meetings had hundreds of people attending?
Yeah, I think the reason I started to do this reporting was going to a meeting up in Nevada County in early December, a fire safety town hall, and I didn't know really what to expect. It was in the big county building, and I got there, and it was, you know, a weeknight, and the whole parking lot was packed. People, as I was walking in, were walking back out of the building. I'm going to go home and listen on the radio. And I was thinking, you know, why aren't they just, you know, they just got here. But I opened the door to the building and the whole lobby and overflow was just packed, let alone the meeting room. Every staff there took every meeting conference room and filled it with people. So mm-hmm. I was taken aback by how many people were motivated to come out and kind of like talk about these concerns.
This is not a one-size-fits-all solution either. Even though there may be one road in and out of a town and one town can share their plan with another town, there are so many unique factors for each area.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in being inspired by the campfire to do these things, I was kind of thinking, well, can we really say that the campfire could happen in one of these other places? And like you're saying, there's unique factors to every area in terms of the terrain, the fuel. The winds were a huge factor, obviously, in the campfire. And also a key factor is fire history. If you, again, going back to the fire history map, if you go look at the area of Paradise, you can, and with the map that our digital data dream team put together, you can just see all the overlay of all these different fire perimeters over the years, and it's just, you know, fire after fire over
time.
That's
why the color coding gives you a sense of where the state has longer history. And it's interesting to see the swath up the middle of the state where there have been no fires. But back to your point about Paradise, there's a lot of history there. And then Nevada City,
there's no fire perimeters right on that area. And so I was talking to CAL FIRE Chief Brian Estes, who is chief for Yuba, Placer, and Nevada counties, about that. And he says, you know, that is a big factor. You know, we're not seeing that pattern there. And that is something as firefighters we do take into consideration. So maybe it's not as prone as somewhere like Paradise, but it does still have the terrain and the fuel, and that fuel hasn't burned in a long time, so that's still a concern for him. So it was interesting to talk to him, asking him, is this an anomaly or not, what we saw in the camp and the car fires? And he actually grew up in Paradise. He said, you know, he was surprised by what happened there, that it was sort of this perfect storm of factors. But then again, every year over the past 5-7 years, he's seen another anomaly event, something that surprises him in the fire service that he thought would only happen one time in his career. So it's kind of complicated there. And he says the big factor in why there's so many more anomalies in his mind is the drought.
I think he had a family member, didn't he, just barely escape the Paradise fire?
So what's interesting is there's a couple different emergency personnel in Nevada County that have really close ties to Paradise.
To Paradise,
that grew up
to
in
Butte
Paradise.
County. Yeah.
Yeah. So another emergency official, the Office of Emergency Services Director John Golsarian for Nevada County, actually used to be the director for Butte County and grew up in Paradise. And I talked to him as well. So it was very interesting to get perspectives on Nevada County from people that know Paradise very, very well. And for John Golsarian, his daughter actually was still living in Paradise. And he actually told us the story of when he was at work in Nevada County that morning when the campfire broke out.
I was in a meeting, you know, monitoring the fire, just as all emergency managers do or fire departments do. And it just was getting bigger and bigger. And then I was, when it was hitting the Feather River Hospital compound campus, I knew that it was a little bit bigger event than we were going to be expecting. My daughter was staying at our house there. She goes to Chico State. And so I was trying to get a hold of her. And a few minutes later, I tried back. And basically, she was in our driveway trying to get out, but it was pitch black outside, smoke. And she could see flames in the distance. And the phone cut off then. And that was pretty much time for me to go run to Paradise. And even though I knew I was not going to be able to go into Paradise and do any help, but I was going to do everything I could to help my daughter in any way that I could. And then fortunately, she did get out, but it was several hours later. There was fire all around her, trees falling down around her. We met on the side of the road, Highway 99, where she'd ran out of gas. And basically, I picked her up off the ground because she was done, emotionally wiped out from the ordeal that she just went through. And we put gas in her car and hugged, and I went back to work because we were under red flag alert here in Nevada County, and you want to be close by if there's a fire starting in your county.
So, you know, a personal note for someone who was also working emergency operations. So he definitely had a connection to what happened up there, but also, you know, is seeing this heightened response even in Nevada County from people wanting to hear stories like that and be proactive.
The stories are hard to hear sometimes. The emotion is so intense, but they will continue on as reminders and anecdotes, family history, community history about what happened. I know some areas are running drills right now to help their citizens be able to respond or formulate a plan. What else? What else is there for people to know? Can anyone start one of these fire safe councils?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of fire safe councils, you can find them. They have Facebook groups, or you can contact your county Office of Emergency Services, and they can help you find information to either start your own or connect you to someone with one of these organizations. And then again, there's just neighbor talking to neighbor, too. Chris Riley, who was driving around the spilled spaghetti roads, has been talking about doing a color-coded evacuation route system where, oh, you know, we're up here at our house. You could take the yellow route out, and you wouldn't receive the information electronically because this reception's so shoddy up there. Mm-hmm. But on your street sign, there would be a little reflective symbol of, like, this is the pink way, the pink route out. Uh-huh. And like you just heard in that story, people are caught in the dark, and they don't know which way to go. They don't have cell phone reception. So that resident, Chris Riley, is working actually with John Golsarian, the emergency services director, on that system. Grassroots efforts on all fronts.
Well, Sally, thank you. I know this is just one aspect of a very large discussion, and we have this little window of time right now while the weather is wet and cold and the fire season is basically diminished, although I'm not going to ever say that it ends. So let's continue the sharing of the work that you're doing and what you're hearing and bringing it to us, because I think everybody benefits.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks.
And back to that color-coded map, too, which is at capradio.org. You are hearing from Cap Radio producer Sally Schilling. Again, Sally, thanks a lot for your work.
Thank you.
This is Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Sometimes, take a deep breath with me, with the weighty issues that we deal with and all the complexities of life around us, it's nice to just take a break from it all, to laugh for a while, especially at the difficulties we deal with. So if that's what you're looking for, mark this Sunday on your calendar. The Invisible Disabilities Comedy Hour is staging its biggest show yet. It's at Punchline Sacramento in the studio with me. Two comedians who are the show's producers, and they are Ali Ada, hi, and Drew Kimsey. Hi, Drew. So, Invisible Disabilities invites obvious questions. One would be, what is one? But why don't you tell me what is one by sharing your own? Ali Ada?
Well, for our show, I have many invisible disabilities. For our show, I do comedy based on my anxiety and depression and my bladder disease. And yeah, so there's a lot of material there.
It feels terrible to laugh at that when you say
that's the thing about the show. We're giving you guys permission to laugh with us. We're allowing you to laugh with us because we're giving you the permission. It's kind of like, it's actually Drew here has an invisible disabilities definition. If you want to talk about that for a second.
Sure. Yeah. So an invisible disability is a physical, mental, or neurological condition that limits a person's movements, senses, or activities that's invisible to the onlooker. So a person can be going through, you know, like Ali said, anxiety, depression, essential tremor, the list goes on. There's hundreds of them, and it leads to misunderstandings because a person may bow out of a situation or a party or whatever it might be, and it, you know, there's a judgment there because you don't know what that person is actually going through. I, for example, over the past couple of years, developed an anxiety disorder. And my world just started getting smaller and smaller. And for that reason, you don't hear about those stories because those people are just kind of receding into the background. That it's intentional. And so we wanted to create a space where it was okay for, it was an open forum for people to talk about that sort of thing. Because we've heard stories about, you know, oh, I was at the bar and bars are bad now. But the people who stay home, we don't get to hear their stories.
Was this because both of you wanted to talk about your own?
Yes.
In part, yeah.
We wanted to, this was actually an experiment for us. We just kind of needed the therapy. Mm-hmm. Like, I love to connect with people. It's almost a need. Like, I have to connect with people in the world. But my anxiety and depression prevent me from doing that. Mm-hmm. And it also prevents me from going out into the comedy community and even functioning in that social realm. Often when I do disabilities material in, say, a showcase or a lineup, you know, all the comedians will be doing very lighthearted stuff. And then I come up and I do my kind of darker disabled material. And sometimes it can bring down the room. And sometimes it can be not something people want to hear at that moment. And so sometimes you get the right kind of audience and sometimes they understand what you're doing. But other times a lot of people get sad. And so we wanted to create a space where that's the expectation. Our audience is there to hear about the invisible disability and they're not going to be thrown a curveball by it. They're there for a reason. And we wanted to set the expectation right from the get-go. And that way no one is, you know, coming to get away from their troubles and then kind of thrown a curveball and, oh, I have to hear depressing stuff.
The headliner for this show on Sunday is Nina G. And we have a clip that not only gives you a sense of the humor of Nina G, but also what you're describing, how people kind of join in and say, it's okay, and we're going to laugh. Mm-hmm.
Stutterers, we are interrupted all the time. Like, I'll be in the midst of a like that. And what the other person will do is this with their hands to, like, hurry it up. Yeah, this has helped me, everyone. This is telling me to spit it out. All very helpful. And I don't know what it is about stuttering or other kinds of disabilities, but as soon as someone meets you, they suddenly have a PhD in the thing you have. Oh my God, I get advice all the time, like, just slow down and breathe. Yeah, in the 38 years I've been stuttering, I've never thought of that.
All right, about why people laugh. You know, we're told that we laugh because we're uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's true? Or do you think we laugh because we're relieved that it's out there, or we want to join in that shared kind of human experience of being, of having gaps?
I think it's a relatability thing. And I think it's kind of a place where we can kind of, we gather to share our pain. And it kind of takes you out of the pain and seeing it from a third person perspective. Yeah, to me, I think it's relatability, especially when people secretly have the thing that you're talking about. A lot of people we've heard from audience members after the show saying like, oh, my gosh, I didn't know that I wasn't the only one. It's so nice to hear you guys actually say what's on my mind or what I'm experiencing at home. And that's the thing about, and anxiety is a common thing that comedians have. Like a lot of our comedians talk about anxiety, and the thing about anxiety is that it lies to you and it tells you that you're the only one who has it and that you're the only one who has these kind of absurd thoughts. And we tend to, like what Drew was saying, retreat and we don't talk to each other. And turns out half the world knows exactly what we're going through.
That's comedian Ali Ada, and Drew Kimsey is in the studio as well. They are producers also of the Invisible Disabilities Comedy Hour, which is this Sunday, 7 o'clock at the Punchline Sacramento. How does it feel, Drew, when people start laughing at the thing that is deep and difficult for you that you're trying to let go of in a way?
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily that I'm trying to let go of it. It's more that part of me never thought that it would be relatable. Like I was in a bad car accident when I was in high school, and I was in a coma because I had a traumatic brain injury. And my experience afterwards, I didn't discuss with other people because I didn't think that they could imagine what that would be like. But at one of our Invisible Disabilities open mics, I actually, just before the open mic, I wrote out the story of what had happened in my accident and how I didn't really understand how the TBI had affected me and how my disability was actually that I don't know what my disability is because I don't have a before and after comparison of what's going on with my brain. Mm. And there was, as when I started talking about that, there was people in the audience just nodding to themselves and muttering like, I know exactly what you're talking about. And it was, there's others out there like you, but if you were trapped in your own head about it, you don't find out about it.
Here's another comedian. This is Nicole Tran. And the first words she's going to say are, I'm from Vietnam. So let's listen.
I'm from Vietnam. Please excuse me the way I speak. There's some letters in the English language that I cannot pronounce. I could tell you which one they are, but I cannot pronounce them. This is a hip crowning and I'm loving it. Sometimes people cannot understand my name over the phone. My name is Tran. Wait a minute. Spell it for me, please. Sure. T like Tiwasaki. R like Rashiko. A like Elasima. And N like Nancy. The other day, I smiled at a handsome American guy. He asked me, are you hitting on me? I go, if I'm not hitting on you, you would be in hospital bed right now.
I thought maybe she was stepping forward with this invisible disability about the way she speaks. But she, too, suffers from some of the deep and hidden issues, anxieties that we're talking about. So how is it for you to be taking this show, this concept, to a bigger stage and a bigger audience?
Well, like we said before, we kind of just did it for ourselves to kind of have our own little bubble where it could be a safe place for us and maybe some of our friends or comedians we knew who had struggles. But like the immediate success of the show just kind of propelled itself. I think Drew had a couple things to say about the success of it and how the demand from comedians as well as audience members just kept it going.
Yeah, it's very much kind of a group therapy situation almost. Like, even if you aren't, you know, going through the anxiety that the comedian is talking about, seeing that degree of honesty on stage is just a really good feeling. I remember at our very first show at Luna's Cafe, I kind of like welled up with tears with like what we had created. I was just really proud of the environment that we had created where people could be so honest, and that degree of honesty, I think, helps them connect with the audience in a way that maybe most comedy doesn't.
Well, congratulations on what you're doing. I'm not sure there's anything more powerful than finding ways that we can connect with each other. So much can come from that. So the show again is Sunday night at the Punchline, 7 o'clock. Bring more humor back. I'm sitting here listening to you, realizing we need more of this and more of the laughter. And I'll say that Amber Whitford is the host of the show. And once again, thank you so, so very much. That's Drew Kimsey and Ali Ada. And good luck with
thank
more shows.
You.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our producers are Cody Drabble and Bert Johnson. We had help from Gabriella Fernandez. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer again today is Anthony Van Hook. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. I hope you too find a moment to laugh in your day. And thanks for joining us.